The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me this Father's Day evening. One of the more innovative players in achieving social impact is the Omidyar Network, established by the founder of eBay, Pierre Omidyar, and his wife, Pam. But the world has changed significantly since it began, so late last year, they introduced a new strategy. And here with us tonight to discuss those changes is Mike Kobzansky, the managing director of the Omidyar Network, who explains part of the impetus for taking a new approach.
So at the highest level, we see a need for a paradigm shift that rebalances the state and markets, that rebalances power away from corporate concentration, that rebalances the power between workers and companies, that rebalances shareholder primacy to take into account a much more broad stakeholders.
And then you'll hear from Adebayo Alonge, co-founder and CEO of RXall. Using artificial intelligence, they have developed a scanner that can detect the ingredients in a pill and, in so doing, help remove fake medicine from the supply chain. And this is no small problem.
In Africa, upwards of between 30 to 50% of the medicines are falsified. In Southeast Asia, the numbers are more between 20 to 30%. And in Latin America, the numbers are between 15 to 20%. So overall, the Global South is more adversely affected by this problem.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, June 16th. Nonprofits help boost voter turnout by 11 percentage points during the 2018 elections, according to a study by Nonprofit Vote. Children aged under 5 carry 40% of the foodborne disease burden, with 125,000 deaths every year. Wells Fargo, the troubled financial services giant, will pump $1 billion from its business and foundation into efforts to make housing more affordable. To lead the effort, the bank has tapped Brandy McHale, a corporate and foundation giving veteran who most recently led the Citi Foundation. Iron Man star Robert Downey has announced a new initiative to clean up the world using robotics, AI, and technology. The actor is calling this new initiative the Footprint Coalition. A survey from the Pew Research Center found that among U.S. workers employed part-time, 64% prefer it that way. Meanwhile, 20% of full-time workers, that's almost 26 million Americans, would rather work part-time. And finally, the proportion of girls worldwide who complete primary school has risen from 76% in 1997 to 90% today. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Mike Kobzansky of the Omidyar Network right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org.
Do you remember your first job? Year Up is empowering low-income young adults with the skills and experience to get their first job. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support opportunity for all. Visit yearup.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
There are only a handful of organizations that look to address societal problems in a multidimensional fashion, seeking new combinations and approaches to achieve impact. Omidyar Network is one of the most highly respected of those in both advancing the conversation and implementing new strategy. It's a delight to have with us tonight the managing director of the Omidyar Network, Mike Kobzansky. Good evening, Mike, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Why don't we start by you giving us some of the history of the Omidyar Network, the founders, and its mission.
That's great. Thanks so much. As I said, it's a pleasure to be here. So we were founded by Pierre and Pam Omidyar, and Pierre is the founder and inventor of eBay, and found himself incredibly wealthy after the IPO at a very young age, and really a little bit before his time committed to using the proceeds of that windfall for the purpose of social impact and social good. And so he and Pam set out on a very intentional journey. And at first they actually set up the Omidyar Family Foundation. And that was a conventional foundation, 501c3, grant-making entity. What they realized after a couple of years is it wasn't nearly able to reach the same scale of impact as the eBay platform was, where literally millions of people had become entrepreneurs and found a way to earn a living, you know, on the eBay platform, and a couple of other things which we now take for granted, which is ways to connect, ways for strangers to connect and transact with each other. And prior to eBay, you know, the notion that you would agree to sell something to a perfect stranger across the country and, you know, and connect was, you know, much more unheard of than it is that we now take for granted. And so there were insights both in terms of the economic platform that eBay created at scale and the connection platform that eBay created at scale. So on that insight, in about 2005, Pierre decided to convert to Omidyar Network, which was really the fundamental insight being the ability to do both commercial investing as a means of generating social impact at scale, which is now later got named impact investing, and, you know, making grants alongside. So that was the origin of it, is the insight of a two checkbook approach, that you can be under the same roof, you can use both your grant writing checkbook and your investing checkbook to drive social impact. And so that was the origin of how we came to be in our current form.
And it's hard to overstate how groundbreaking that was. As you just said a moment ago, we take all this for granted today, the LLCs and the 501c4s and the social enterprises. And I think many people wonder, where did it ever get started? And I recall back at that time, too, there was a lot of pushback. Muhammad Yunus and microfinance and commercial microfinance. Sure. And it just wasn't, you know, embraced right away, was it?
Right. No, and I don't want to take undue credit. There were a lot of people, particularly in the U.S., in the CDFI movement for decades, who had been, you know, as with Yunus had been doing in the 70s, and in the U.S., the CDFI movement, LISC, Enterprise, all the CDCs who are doing low-income housing and job work. Like, so impact investing in that sense is not new. And they were funded generously by Ford and MacArthur with PRIs along the way. So we would be loath to take credit for something that started well before us. But applying it with a venture lens is something I think that we've historically done more of than most people, to take how do you take that venture capital sort of Silicon Valley lens on it, high risk sets of things to do. And again, lots of things that, you know, I once had the privilege of doing a brief summer internship at Shore Bank in Chicago. That was a very high risk, you know, set of PRIs for Ford and MacArthur and others to make as well. So again, not saying that we have a monopoly on risk, but how do you take that venture mindset and stamp it onto a philanthropy and really see what kind of social impact you can drive by doing that? And so that was the origin of the thinking. And yes, that was new and controversial. And we've been gratified to see other people coming at it over time and doing the same thing through either forming an LLC or, and, you know, some foundations are now putting large chunks of their endowments aside for, you know, mission-oriented investing. And so it's been nice to see the movement in that direction, where this is no longer a, you know, a heretical thing to be doing.
For sure. Yeah. And since its origins, how much has the organization invested, and what has the focus of those investments and grants been?
Yeah, so over time, and again, this gets complicated because we've recently gone through a reorganization to stand up and independently a number of our longest standing initiatives, which I'll take you through if your listeners are interested. But historically, about $1.4 billion since inception, and about 53 to 55% of that has been as grants. And as my predecessor, Matt Bannock, used to say, 100% guaranteed loss of principal investments. The other 45% has been in the form of some kind of equity, typically an equity investment, early stage equity investment in a in a startup company. And one startup company, for instance, that we invested in, which has done quite well, for instance, a company called D-Lite, which does low-cost solar lanterns and solar home systems in emerging markets in Africa and India.
Great organization.
Yeah, and we are really proud of them and the work that they've done and have who have been along the way. And I'll talk later on. I can talk some more recent investments.
Mm-hmm. Well, toward the end of last year, October to be precise, you announced a new strategy, a new approach focusing on several key areas, and we're going to get a chance to speak about a couple of those. But first, what was the impetus for taking this new tact?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, because there are sort of two, there was two impetus. One was actually we had, and this is the privilege of working for Pam and Pierre, is that Pierre had the insight that things should not stay static forever. Mm-hmm. And the insight that it would be a good time to change and stand up some of our longest standing initiative areas. So our financial inclusion team has now stood up and spun off as Flourish Ventures, and our governance and civic engagement team has now stood up and spun off as Luminate. Mm-hmm. And they're doing really interesting work and continuing to do the work they did. But so one impetus was we were changing the organization fundamentally by spinning off our longstanding entities who are continuing to do the excellent work that they do. The second impetus, though, was taking a look around, that this was the first time, as a result, the first time we really did a strategy reset since 2007. And a lot in the world had changed.
Oh, yeah.
And so looking around at a very different world in 2018 from a world in 2007, if you look around, our assumptions and hypotheses were built on two key assumptions, both of which I think are at a minimum open to question, and in some cases the evidence is pretty clear. One is that democracy, not just in the U.S., but including in the U.S., is stable and not under threat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is certainly open to interpretation. And the second is that markets are adjudicating returns and profits fairly and equally and generating the prosperity that they need to. And I think on the second question, that was one of the assumptions of the old strategy of being in on market-based solutions. And there, I think the evidence is pretty strong, you know, in terms of the inequality levels that have become quite apparent post the Great Recession, and not just in the U.S., in many other places, that markets are not doing the job that they, you know, that we have expected them to do, and in at least their current format. And so it was a real chance to take a step back, say the world is really different.
Mm-hmm.
Right now. We have illiberal governments in a number of countries. We have, you know, high levels of inequality. And from the point of view that we've discussed, first of all, we feel some comfort that we're not the only ones taking that two checkbook impact investing approach anymore. So that freed us up to take a look at some different issues and some different ways of doing business. But really, really mostly inspired by taking a hard look at the world around us and the sort of core assumptions of that, you know, really being ripe for reinspection.
Yeah, and my observation would also be that in Silicon Valley, where you're based, there's been a little bit of skepticism, or at least pumping on the brakes, that market forces alone were not going to solve these social problems. And technology, with all its great possibilities, also had its limitations, and those limitations sometimes were not all good. And there seems to have been that hesitation to say we need to, as you say, reset, take a step back, and really look at this. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, so I don't want to speak for others, but I certainly think, yeah, we're hardly the only ones who have had this observation. A number of things that we wish had been clearer at the time became clearer post-2016 between Brexit and the election in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and a number of other things that were clearly brewing under the surface for a while. And that became much more apparent since sort of 2013, 2014 is when things started to really become more apparent that we need to think about things in potentially a different or more expansive way, I would say, not necessarily, you know, completely different. So there is a growing recognition, and you see it in some ways in terms of the UBI conversation coming out of Silicon Valley.
Yep.
In terms of
that being universal basic
income. Universal basic income, exactly. You see it in other ways among our other sort of social impact, you know, foundations and investors, you know, starting to think about these sets of issues. But so I don't think we're the only ones who had this insight at all, but it was a it was a moment since we were already reinventing the organization to really take a step back and reorient around these priorities.
Well, one of those priorities is to reimagine capitalism and to build a more equitable society. Flesh that out a little bit for us in terms of your vision for that.
Sure. No, that's great. And yeah, and that's a nice small goal that we should be done with in a year. That's a joke. So what we mean by there is, one of the things that became apparent when we looked at our strategy and we looked at the world around us is that the capitalist system is failing.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a reason we called it reimagining capitalism and not promoting millennial socialism. We are believers in the capitalist system and what it can do. And you see examples in Europe and elsewhere of a capitalist system that have that creates broad-based growth and benefits. So, but underneath that, this starts at the highest level from the point of view of the observation that we are all operating under the Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek paradigm of what's been conveniently called neoliberalism. And our view is that is past its sell-by date. It's no longer an effective way to govern. And every assumption about the balance between states and markets, between companies and individuals, companies and unions, company concentration, comes from this underlying mindset of the Chicago School of Economics.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the highest level, reimagining capitalism for us is supplanting the Chicago School of Economics with a better new set of ideas. And we think this is an ideal role for philanthropy, and we've been working very closely, if you've seen Larry Kramer's letter, for instance, to his board on this. We've been working very closely with Larry and Hewlett on this. We think there's a unique role for philanthropy to play. In fact, Hayek and Friedman themselves and the Mont Pelerin Society were funded by philanthropy. Their development of their ideas in the Chicago School of Economics didn't happen in a vacuum. They had philanthropists funding them. So at the highest level, we see a need for a paradigm shift that rebalances the state and markets, that rebalances power away from corporate concentration, that rebalances the power between workers and companies, that rebalances shareholder primacy to take into account a much more broad stakeholder. So at the highest level, we think of reimagining capitalism as the mindsets, ideas coming out of the academy and think tanks about that organize the economy. Underneath that, we have three or four areas where we're first looking as we get into this space. One is what we call worker power.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people worrying about future of work, and that's good, and we do too. We are very worried about AI and its upcoming effect on jobs. But one of the things we're concerned with as well is what institutionally, and this is, I think, part of the evolving focus, right? We've always been concerned with impact at scale, primarily through innovative companies. And what we're adding to that is thinking about the institutions and the sort of the power architecture of the system. And so institutionally, labor, not necessarily labor unions, but workers, one, are getting more fragmented by the gig economy and people having 2, 3, 4 jobs. And two, their ability to negotiate for their share of the productivity. I don't know if you've seen the Economic Policy Institute's classic chart where wage growth stays flat from the 70s to today, but profits and profitability and productivity have gone up in a very sharp upward to the right angle. So we think there are a variety of ways that need to get closer. One is there's a lot of people working on skilling, but one is just increasing institutionally and structurally the bargaining power of workers to have the ability. This is one of the reasons we supported the ballot initiative in Maine, for instance.
Right. Although it wasn't successful, you made a statement.
It was not successful, and we learned from it. And we'll talk about risk in a second. But the idea was that proposed to give workers a seat at the table on how the home care industry worked in Maine, in that state. And that was, one that overlaps to our third area, which is the safety net, right? What is the safety net, particularly if there's going to be increasing acceleration of dislocation from jobs? And then two, how do you build in so that was a twofer for us because mm-hmm. it was both about the safety net that's in place and about a segment of workers who are low paid, typically forgotten, and getting them a seat at the table. And so we are interested, the worker power is aimed at that. We are also interested in this notion of safety nets. Under that aegis, we've looked at, we've funded several pilots and efforts on UBI, for instance, on universal basic income as one entry into that. And the other pieces that we're really currently pursuing is around concentration of power monopolies.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've made several grants recently to Open Markets Institute. He would be a great guest. to Public Knowledge and others to start thinking about modern antitrust theory in a world where, take the tech platforms, consumer harm can't be determined from price.
Yeah.
And so, again, thinking now with a broader lens about power and distribution of power, how do you keep checks on concentration of power?
Yeah, well, and clearly it seems you're moving upstream. You're much more involved in policy and 501c4 work, perhaps, than you have been in the past, because you realize if you don't change the system at that level, you really minimize the impact you could have at the other.
Yes, and we've always been interested in system change, and that's been a, we even have at the Omidyar Group a systems practice, a systems and complexity practice, and a systems and complexity coach. And then there are various ways you can cut into a system. So in certain sectors, like some of the things that are less regulated, you can cut in with a disruptive entrepreneur, can change the system, particularly if they can develop a standard or can be if through their success others will copy and compete the same way. So there are multiple ways to address the system. But yes, for some of these things that we're now looking at, we've drawn the conclusion that in addition to the other tools we're using, and I'll come back when we talk about technology, I'll come back to how we're thinking about the full spread of tools.
Yeah.
In addition to the other tools we're using, it's become clear to us that we need to exactly come into the upstream, whether it's the mindsets and the beliefs of the system at the Friedman level, whether it's the rules of the game at the Justice Department, antitrust level, or whether it's some of these other balance of power things in terms of who gets a seat at the table.
That's where those levers are, right there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's different. That's a shift for us, and that's different kind of work from how we certainly started. And so it'll take some time for us to get used to working in these kind of different areas. And it means we're now spending time with some new kinds of grantees who think about this on a more regular basis than we had in the past.
Sounds interesting.
It's good
fun. Before we move on to technology, you mentioned something that not enough people talk about these days, as far as I'm concerned, and that is the gig economy. Seems that we're living in the present, and we know that 90% of the jobs are all coming from the gig economy. As you look at a 21st century social contract, you have to address the gig economy because that's where it's all going. I did have Lila Jana from Samosource on the show recently, and they're one of the few organizations that are actually having a training program for young people to prepare themselves for the gig economy. Give us your thoughts on how that's going to change the nature of work and how society needs to prepare for that.
Good. So I think the nature of work and then worker power, right? How do you, the conventional trade union, for instance, was built on a factory floor and everybody's in the same place and everybody has one job. The gig economy, and we've seen vastly differing and disagreeing statistics in terms of how big or not it's going to be. And even the Bureau of Labor Statistics is coming up with differing numbers from study to study. And so sizing it is a difficult task, but it does seem quite evident in more and more people. Right. It's becoming a mode. And this is a place where, the emerging markets are always gig economy. Most people don't have formal employment, and they've always been in the gig economy. So the trick is, how do you get people in emerging markets to more formal economy? And in the U.S., how do you adjust from an economy where it's been formal single employment to a world where the people will have two and three gigs as well? So one, it would be great to be in a world where people didn't have to have a gig job to make ends meet if they weren't being so underpaid at their primary job. Given that that is continuing to be the direction of travel, I think there's a couple of challenges that come up from the gig economy. One is, how do people get benefits? In the U.S., at least, the benefits are tied to your employment status. Mm-hmm. And so Obamacare has been a helpful detachment from that. And we're looking at a bunch of things in the portable benefits space. We did work with the Black Car Fund here, for instance, to look at their drivers and what kind of benefits they would preserve. But if benefits are tied to employment and more people are in the gig economy not having formal employment, then those benefits need to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
And they may have different preferences as to benefits, whether they want health or disability or other things as well. So the benefits preferences might shift as well. The second thing that raises is, you know, can benefits be a way in which workers actually do aggregate, right? In terms of that, can that be a platform by which gig workers could get together and have at a minimum better purchasing power for benefits, but at a maximum have better voice and bargaining power over other conditions and things as well? And so we're interested in that. We're interested in that angle on things as well. I think the other question is in a gig economy, and this gets into SEC rules and a bunch of other things, but you know, we saw with the Lyft and the Uber IPOs, mm-hmm. and there's an Airbnb one coming up. I think there's work to revisit in terms of worker ownership. And if there can't be ownership in the conventional shareholding, is there a role, for instance, for in a typical Uber or Lyft setup, right, there are, you know, in most companies, there are depreciable assets that mm-hmm. are owned by the companies. For the most part, in a Lyft or an Uber, the depreciable assets are owned by the individuals and the drivers. Is there some way that they could not benefit as, you know, from the depreciation of that and get dividend checks in lieu of, you know, in lieu of actual ownership, but in recognition of the fact that it's their assets that are being depreciated to provide the profits to the company.
Makes sense.
I think there's interesting work to be done in thinking through creative options like that.
Yeah, because you look at that sometimes and you say the workers are not making any money, the company's not making any money, the investors are making all the money.
Yeah.
They just showed up yesterday.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to make an awful lot of sense.
Yeah, although, right, we can get into the share price tracking on these companies too.
You know, another big area is the beneficial use of technology. And there is so much to talk about there. But why don't we start with a term you've been using for about 3 years now called good ID. How do you characterize the forms of digital identity which are considered to be good?
Yes, excellent. And this should be available on our website for people who want to track in on this in more detail. Let me take one step back up and then come back down to the ID thing.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, and again, with our eBay heritage, we've always thought about technology, right? We are from Silicon Valley. We think hard. And for a long time, our premise was that technology is a great force for good and for expanding the franchise and for making people who are unseen and unincluded seen and included.
Yeah.
Now I think we need to think about the opposite, which is, can people be too seen and too included and against their will?
Mm-hmm.
And so our beneficial tech is really about how do we get the benefits of technology out there, but in ways where there are guardrails to being, you know, so you are as seen as you want to be, but no more seen than that, right? And as included as you want to be, but no more included than that. Digital ID is a good case of that, where countries around the world, particularly in emerging markets, Africa, South Asia, India, has issued a billion of these state-issued digital identities. This is fantastic from an inclusion point of view. People can open bank accounts. They can have access to state benefits. It's a very inclusive-oriented development. But there are clear risks in the issuance of the IDs in terms of surveillance, privacy invasions, and other things. So our initial focus on ID came out of this focus on state-issued IDs, where most countries, Kenya, Nigeria, India, a bunch of countries Bangladesh, are all issuing digital IDs. But how do you govern these digital identities in a way that is privacy-protecting? Now, in India, that turned out as a very public fight in the all the way up to the Supreme Court level, where they had to rule on a right to privacy and the limitations of the program. And again, back to institutions. The institutions in India worked pretty well. The state came out with a program. Civil society and the media made a series of cases as to why the program might have been overreaching. And the courts decided and put boundaries on the program, and the system got better.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so, again, with our institutional hat, thinking about what are the institutions that need to be in play to put the same checks and balances on the system that worked well in India are there. And the notion on good ID is that, you know, from the development point of view, you want as many people to have an ID as possible. But we want to make sure that as people issue IDs, that they are bounded with checks and balances on the system, that users can opt out, that users can protect their privacy, that users have the ability to use an offline ID if they choose to or a different kind of ID if they want to. So really building this notion of individual agency and choice into the ID that it's not simply a state-issued, required-for-everything system and that something can be ultimately used for nefarious or other purposes. And so what we're trying to do as that momentum gets started is really shift the debate to it's not about how many IDs you've issued full stop. It's about how many IDs you've issued that conform to this definition that really put the user at the center of the work. And that's the notion on good ID. And from there, it's relatively easy to think, well, actually, you have your officially issued ID, but you also have a de facto digital trail ID.
That's right.
And so how do you give users in the digital economy more broadly that same ability to control and permission their identity, their data, their use of data? And so that has spread into a variety of areas. So here's a place where we use all the tools in the toolkit. We have a commercial investment in a company called Digi.me, which allows you to download your data, control who you give it to, and control who you not give it to, and puts you in control of whether you want to share your social media data with others and not vice versa. And it could also be your call data records, and it could also be your Snapchat activity. And so there's a variety. It's a tool like that. But in addition, thinking about how we get other investors to commit to good data practices and good data policies and the kinds of companies they'll invest. So we've introduced with a number of other fellow investors around a race to the top for sort of high quality data practice, and then looking at the rules of the game again, you know, what should be data privacy laws and data privacy protections in both emerging markets and in developed markets. So we're working with data protection authorities in Europe, for instance. To help them enforce data privacy laws. And so looking across, and this is where I think the mix of the Omidyar Network toolkit really comes into play.
It really does,
everything
yeah.
at the.
And
yeah.
There's some general guidelines. I think the World Bank has put them out, but there are really no global standards right now. And that recent report that you were working with McGinsey Global Institute on, I believe it said that 3-13% of GDP can be traced to good digital ID, and 50% of it will be amassed by the consumer, but only if there is trust.
Exactly.
How confident are you about that trust?
Well, that's what we're working so hard to try to build. That's why the Good ID movement. And I think it will vary,
mm-hmm.
one country by country to company by company, right? I think you know there's more trust in Apple than there is in Facebook, even.
Right? I think
and so,
right.
So I think it's... I think we're worried about it, right?
Mm.
In terms of, and this is the moment as people roll these systems out to build in the safeguards and the trusts in the systems. 3 years from now, it's going to be too late, right? Now that when they're rolling the systems out, which is why we feel a real sense of urgency around this, most of the new ID systems are going to be issued in Africa, and so we're working with UNECA, for instance, in Africa to. On a broader kind of digital economy envelope of things that would build trust in the digital economy. Because if that's not there, people won't use the system. If they feel they're going to be spied upon. And lots of countries have issued ID systems,
mm-hmm.
and they just don't get used because
yeah.
there's low levels of trust in them. And so then you've got the worst of all possible worlds. There's no inclusion. There's no trust. And a lot of money got spent from the Treasury.
Absolutely. For not much, very little utility. And there's really no legacy systems there that can even replace it. There's just nothing.
Right.
One last word about this Responsible Computer Science Challenge that you're a part of. You just announced some of the winners. Tell us about that challenge.
Oh, we're excited about this.
You should be.
Yeah. So, again, coming at the most broad level of the system, right, for how do you make technology companies be their best selves? In addition, and again, we're coming at it from all sides, whether it's the monopoly regulation side, whether it's the sort of the digital trail side. This is a side of working with tech and their workers, right, with tech companies. This comes out of a set of impulses that we've had to work with tech companies and their workers. So our grantees, .everyone in the UK, just released this fascinating survey of UK tech workers and their attitudes towards privacy, regulation, AI ethics and a bunch of things. And it occurred to us and a number of our co-funders at Schmidt Futures and Mozilla that actually nobody is – there's a bunch of tech workers who are deeply concerned about that. And we found a lot of engagement with tech workers who really do care about what their companies are doing and who they're doing business with and how they're doing business. And you've seen this, right, with Google, Project Maven and a number of other things where the workers have actually started to really raise their voices in certain cases, and we think that's healthy. And again, it fits with our worker power thesis.
Mm-hmm.
But So the Responsible CS Challenge is an attempt to really provide some momentum to having people, as they learn to code, think about the societal implications of that, of their work, to not just think about the code, but to think broader about the context into which they're launching their activities, and sending them at, and, you know, most of these schools are the pipeline for where if you're Uber or Google or whomever are drawing your coders, right? Many of these schools are the place where they're coming from. So we view this as a very important way at the source to start broadening awareness that code is not written in a vacuum. Products come out into a societal context, and thinking about unintended consequences, thinking about alternate use cases. Most technology, we've learned, is dual use,
yeah.
Right? having folks aware of that at the outset, we think will make for a healthier ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Let's turn our attention to impact investing. And as you know, there's been this discussion going on for a long, long time as to whether you could earn market competitive returns,
yes,
and still have social and environmental impact, or whether you had to accept a concessionary return to achieve those objectives. You have sought to take this conversation to the next stage, and you have an initiative called Beyond Trade-Offs. What's the gist?
The gist is we don't think it's an either-or. And for a long time, and I was a vice chair of the Emerging Markets Private Equity Association Impact Investing Council, and they just had their annual meeting. And you'd go to the meetings, and people would put in advertisements into their program saying, such and such fund, impact investing, no trade-offs. And it's great. So that's good. And if you're out there raising money from commercial LPs, that's a great stance to have. But realistically, in the financial markets writ large, there's all kinds of gradations, right? Different asset classes have different return profiles, different horizons. Long-term investors look at things quite different from day traders. There's a number of different aspects of the market. The impact investing market is and should be no different. There ought to be, from our point of view, segments of the impact investing market where there is absolutely, and we have a number of, in fact, the majority of ON's investments were made on the premise of, we expect to get a market rate return. There's a separate question as to how do you estimate what a market rate return should be in a country like Zambia,
mm-hmm.
right, where there's relatively little private investment in venture companies in the first place. But we'll leave that aside. Assuming you can figure out what a market rate return is, yes, there ought to be a segment for which you should and ought to expect market rate returns, and there's a strong discipline in that. And we think there are investments that absolutely, and we've seen this in our financial inclusion work, that absolutely can meet both hurdles, high social impact, high competitive commercial returns, and off to the races. But we also think that there are segments where that equation just won't clear. Patient capital is required, so you might get a good return on a multiple of invested capital basis. But once you've done the time value, particularly if you're in an emerging market, which is a thin market with a lot of exits, available to you, it might just take longer,
yeah.
Right? And so it's still a good investment, but it may not be a fully market rate return. And there are other things which we think are just going to ultimately require subsidy in the form of below market returns to be able to clear. And there ought to be a segment for that too. And so it ought not to be a one size fits all. The idea on Beyond Trade-Offs is there are certain situations and markets and characteristics of investments. And that's one of the reasons we were excited to go in with MacArthur Foundation and Rockefeller Foundation on the Catalytic Capital Consortium, C3, to really put a pool aside to experiment with these kind of below market rate, but still commercial, but still providing a return categories of investments to really articulate, because there's been a lot of activity in impact investing at the market rate return. If you look at the GIN surveys, most people say they're chasing market rate returns. And that's great. And we have investments in funds for whom that is their goal, and we're delighted to be alongside with them for that. But the idea on the C3 was, how can you capitalize some experimentation on, say, okay, so how would it actually work for that segment of investments? And maybe it's long-term stuff, maybe it's climate stuff. Prior to my career at ON, I did a lot of research at Monitor on business models that serve low-income segments. And there are certain low-income segments that are simply not going to be reachable at commercial returns. You might be able to get somewhat of a return, but it's still really valuable to reach that consumer segment. And so those might be a segment where to get to rural low-income populations in an emerging market in Africa. There may be some, and again, I don't want anybody to take away from this, oh, that's the only way you can do it. There will be commercial rate returns as well,
right,
in an emerging market, say Kenya. But there will be cases where to reach, for instance, a particularly low-income segment, the business model is not going to be to generate full commercial returns.
Right. Well, as you say, it's a continuum.
Exactly.
And it's like going to a grocery store and deciding what aisle you want to walk down.
Exactly.
Not just two aisles.
Exactly.
It's a lot of aisles.
And we have the luxury of being at Omidyar Network both an investor and a grant maker, so we can play across that. And we recognize that for commercial LPs, like, they can't afford to play in the below market rate zone, and nor, you know, and they've got fiduciary obligations and that sort of thing. So they're not our audience when we talk about this sort of thing. We know what their constraints are and that sort of thing. But family offices, high net worth foundations, donor agencies, USAID, DFID, these sorts of folks, for them, we think they really should be thinking about this full spectrum of capital.
Let me ask you, Mike, a word or two about your organizational culture. Why is it such a special place to work, and what do you do to help shape and influence it?
Yes, this is where my three improv classes comes into play. So the culture at ON came out of this eBay ethos, sort of at the beginning, and has evolved over time. But it has been a constant focus on entrepreneurs and entrepreneurialism. We've always been anchored on impact at scale. So people come, they really come because they really want to dedicate their lives to impact. And they come from all kinds of places, whether from IPA or from, we've got ex-JP Morgan people, we've got ex-Google people, we've got a few reformed ex-consultants like myself. I think the main thing is, and you see this right in an organization that's willing to split itself into pieces and reinvent itself periodically, right, is a high tolerance for risk, right, which is a real willingness to take a risk, try something new, and this is something, even though this is already in our DNA, I work hard to kind of further this and talk about. So this is why we went public, for instance, that we funded the main campaign and that we failed on the main campaign, right? To sort of say, the main campaign failed. We learned a lot from it. We took a risk. It didn't pay off, but it's really informed how we think in the future about how we engage on both worker power issues and how we engage with tools like ballot questions.
So in that sense, it did pay off.
Exactly. So it didn't pay off in an immediate policy win, but it did, there were other benefits to having done it. And so I think in general, ON's a good place if you have a high tolerance for ambiguity, you like to take risk, you're excited about having social impact and constantly kind of pushing to the cutting edge. And so I think there's and really thinking about a blue sky idea. And so that means that every now and again, we're going to shake ourselves up and do sorts of things. So it's not an institution. I once had the privilege of working at the World Bank. It's not an institution.
No,
it's not the same kind of culture and the same kind of place. And it's not a good fit for people who are looking for a...
Yeah, it sounds to me that if you're not comfortable with change, do not apply.
Yes, that would be a fairly succinct watchword.
Yes. Yeah. Let me close with this, Mike. You have been out front on so many of the developments that have occurred in the social sector. What do you think might be coming next? Do you think we're going to see an acceleration of some of the present trends, or do you think we might be in for some pretty big disruptions?
Yeah, so I think some stuff we've seen will continue. We feel like there's good momentum, for instance, behind the impact investing trend. I think that will continue, although I think we worry about there's a lot of now straight commercial money coming in from private equity funds and that sort of thing. So keeping the impact in the impact investing is going to be important. But we see that really gathering momentum and moving forward.
Living up to the hype, so to speak.
Yeah, and catching up to the aspiration that they feel when the Rockefeller Foundation convened people in Bellagio in
12 years ago or something like that. Yeah,
in 07 or 08, the idea that trillions of dollars would move into the sector, I think that's no longer as far-fetched as it would have seemed a decade ago. So we see momentum there. We're hoping there's a trend around this kind of incorporating user feedback. A Fund for Shared Insight and others are kind of moving. We'd love to see that become more embedded feedback labs, some of these groups that are mm-hmm. working on that. But I think there's a couple of new things that are coming up, which I think could be disruptive, but I think are also healthy. So I think, and one of the things in our evolution, right, thinking more about institutions, right, or coming back in cases of some, you know, Ford Foundation's been thinking about it for a while. So again, it's not brand new, but I think there's a lot of questioning currently of institutions, of the institution of philanthropy itself, and questioning of all institutions, whether it's government, philanthropy, the media. You know, the Edelman Trust barometers are fascinating in this regard, and so I think there's a potentially strong threat of disruption around that, or at least forcing a re-questioning, which I think is healthy for philanthropy. It's healthy for us. I think it's healthy for the sector. And I'd say one of the things I've observed, and this might simply be our own journey along the way, and everybody's been doing it, but I think in general people are thinking more about power. Mm-hmm. Right, in terms of, and so thinking, and I don't think it's just us, but it could be. But I think there's this kind of awakening to how power is distributed in society, and you start to see more and more of that. And coming back to these kind of first principles, and that I think is also, I think, healthy, right? I think, you know, sociologists think about power all the time, and it's good that, you know, philanthropists are starting to think about that too.
I think you're absolutely right, and I can't tell you the number of young people I've encountered who are not that interested in politics until you tell them politics is about power.
Right.
And all of a sudden they they light up and say, I want to get involved in that. Well, Mike Kobzansky, the managing director of the Amitiar Network, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Your organization generates some of the most interesting material to be found on all these issues. Tell us a little bit about your website and some of the info that you do have there.
Great. So omidyar.com. And we have another one that you might find, particularly if anyone's listening in India, which is omidyarnetworkindia.com. So you can find our India team's work under that website. But the work that I've mostly been describing now is at omidyar.com, and you'll find things like, and increasingly one of this is what we're doing more of, for instance, the good ID work that you were citing. We're starting to publish our points of view on things. So to be more transparent, what do we believe? What are we trying to get done? That sort of thing. So over time, that's the first of them. And over time, we'll be publishing more of those. And people will be able to kind of see a little bit more about that sort of thing. In the meantime, that has the four areas under reimagining capitalism that we're currently working mm-hmm. on, including impact investing, some ongoing work in the property rights space. as well as the new areas I described to you. Similar on the technology, that sort of thing. Our grantees are listed there, new and old, can be found there. And profiles of the team for anybody who's really
really wants to get into this.
Figure out who, right.
Jessica, and I'll just add one thing. That's just another change we're seeing. Organizations like yours taking a stance and taking a position and citing your opinion, something that wasn't done a decade ago. It was such a pleasure to have you on the show, Mike.
Oh, my pleasure, Denver. Thank you so much for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
It is said the best entrepreneurs are those who have encountered the problem themselves. In the case of my next guest, he survived being in a coma for 21 days as a result of receiving fake medicine. And every year, tens of thousands of people across the world die because of these fake drugs. So he set out to do something about it. And has he ever? He is Edebaye Alonge, the founder and CEO of RxAll. Good evening, Edebaye, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Let's begin by having you tell us your story, the one that almost ended your life.
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of asthma about 15 years ago while I was growing up in Nigeria. And my dad was asked to buy me Ventolin tablets. I used a 4-milligram dose in the afternoon and another 4-milligram dose at night. And unfortunately, in the morning, I did not wake up. and I was told that I was in a coma for about 21 days, during which the doctors battled to keep fluids out of my lungs. After analysis of the pill, it was found that it had a very high dose of a very common sleeping agent. And so this is what had put me into a very deep sleep and led to other complications further down the line.
Mm-hmm. Give us a little bit more of the dimensions of this problem. What parts of the world is it most acute, and who are the main culprits?
Yeah, so there was a WHO study from 2017 that said that about 10% of all the drugs in the world are falsified. And typically falsified medicines are those drugs that lie about their composition, their identity, or their source.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the numbers are even bigger if we're talking about substandard drugs. So substandard drugs are those medicines that are out of specifications, that don't meet the required quality levels as defined by their monograph of preparation. And in Africa, upwards of between 30 to 50% of the medicines are falsified. In Southeast Asia, the numbers are more between 20 to 30%. And in Latin America, the numbers are between 15 to 20%. So overall, the Global South is more adversely affected by this problem. In terms of the culprits, most of the substandard medicines that go into Southeast Asia and Africa come primarily from India and China. Substandard medicines that go into South America and the United States typically come from Paraguay and Colombia. So these are the figures from the 2017 report from the WHO.
So you set out to create a solution, Edibio, and tell us what it is and how it works.
Yeah, so we built out while we were, myself and two of my other co-founders, while we were studying at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
In 2015, we built out a platform known as Arexol. Primarily, it's an AI platform that enables drug regulators carry out real-time drug quality checking, reporting, and surveillance of the supply chain. So they can see across a countrywide basis, real-time, the level of quality across different points of the supply chain. And so they're able to actually recall bad and substandard drugs, and they're able to pinpoint the culprits who are responsible for selling or bringing into the supply chain this substandard product. So our solution essentially goes beyond just falsified drugs. We're also picking up very poor quality medications that previously, nobody was actually taken out of the system. And why our system is really very important is that in terms of poor quality drugs in the supply chain, it leads to about $50 million in repeat therapy in Africa alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so helping regulators remove poor quality medicines from the supply chain improves overall healthcare outcomes, improves or reduces the overall cost of health therapeutic treatment, and reduces the number of deaths. I mean, there are over 1 million people who die every year because of substandard drugs. And so our goal is to help the regulators sanitize the supply chain system and make sure that people are protected and that they're only getting the best drugs that is possible within their healthcare system.
That's absolutely incredible. How does that work, for instance, if you have an RX scanner and you scan it over a particular pill? How are you able to detect the information as to what's in that pill?
Yeah, so we built out a proprietary machine learning app that is able to read the what we call the molecular spectral fingerprint of the pill. And so the AI has memorized what a typical high-quality medicine fingerprint looks like within acceptable manufacturing variations. And so when a substandard product that has maybe degraded or is poorly manufactured or has been falsified is scanned by our RX scanner, that fingerprint is sent into the cloud where we have our AI compare it and analyze it to what it has memorized as the high-quality fingerprint. And if it's very different or outside of the acceptable manufacturing bounds, which is usually the case with poor quality or falsified drugs, it picks that out and sends it back into the mobile app as a substandard drug, and also indicates in the mobile application the level of quality of that drug. And then immediately it sends that information into the surveillance map where the drug regulator is able to see it as an alert on their system. They're able to pinpoint the GPS location of the scan. They're able to have a sense of where the pharmacy is that has made that supply. And they're able to then compare with all of the other scans that have happened in the country. And if they're seeing a sort of a repeated poor quality of the specific brand or the specific batch number, they can then actually do a real-time recall across the country to remove that poor quality drug from the supply chain.
Very, very cool. What's your business model? Is it from the sale of these scanners or the data you're able to collect, or is it just a combination of things?
Yeah, so it's we sell primarily subscription mm-hmm. to the platform, and the subscription helps the regulators deploy the scanners across different testing points in the country. It also covers the cost for the scanning and the database build out and the database management. And so all of this subscription access enables them to have access to the full platform and the data and analytics that is also created as a result of all the scanning that's taking place.
And this work has been recognized in a variety of ways, but perhaps most prominently when you guys were named the grand winner of the Hello Tomorrow Global Challenge, beating out 4,500 other deep tech companies. Congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
What's the impact of that been on the company?
It's raised the profile of the company internationally. And so what it has led to directly is that we now have moved into South America, specifically in Colombia, working with local Colombia and Honduras, working with local partners there. We've also been able to get into Southeast Asia, now working out in Thailand and Myanmar, and also into East Africa, working with Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda. So overall, I would say it's raised our profile and helped us get more users across the world.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Edibio, not that you don't have your hands full with this, but are there any other ambitions you harbor in the medical field or in the field of deep tech to promote social good?
Yes. Another area that I would definitely love to look into is the use of AI for healthcare diagnosis. So Africa has a severe deficit, or the developing world as a whole has a severe deficit of doctors. And what is possible is that if we have an AI system that can almost serve as a doctor, we can implement that in a number of test locations, especially in rural parts of Africa, and then tying the AI's recommendations to a human doctor in the city to spit out prescriptions and diagnoses in order to treat more patients. So definitely this is one area that I would definitely be very much interested in. Another area is which I'm looking into is actually what we call a pharmacy platform that helps to improve access to high-quality medicines for patients in rural areas. So using their mobile phone, they can easily find high-quality pharmaceuticals around them, interact with the pharmacists in a market network, social network system, get the primary diagnosis from the pharmacies, fill out their prescriptions, and get their medicines without having to leave their homes. So these are two applications that I'm really excited about, and hopefully further down the line, I'll be looking to explore.
Well, great stuff. Stay excited and stay ambitious. Edibio Alonge, founder and CEO of RxAll, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For listeners who want to learn more about this incredible work, tell us about your website and what they'll find there.
Yeah, so we are at www.rxall.net. on our website, you can contact us and reach out to us if you're looking to be a partner, either as a distributor or as a donor. More countries do need some support with donations to get the platform into more areas in the developing world. And you'd also find some details about the team as well as the solution as well. We're very happy to hear back from you and to connect with you as a partner.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Adebayo. It was great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Carrie Putnam, the executive director of the Sundance Institute, who, of course, puts on the Sundance Film Festival. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.